I find that, you know, you can't seem to go into these times when you're sharing your faith, and when you kind of go through the, we're all in process, right? We all have this journey that we're on. And the thing that I've said this so many times that I love about this church is that it's okay to be in process. And as I was thinking about this whole time that I was going to be able to share with you tonight, I was doing some studying. It's been a long time, and there was a guy that, it's a tape series, and his subject was how the first century Christians experienced the divine, I think it was. It was really an interesting series. But then, as you know, the weeks went by, and with all the things that were going on in my life, I decided to kind of take this diversionary angle and talk about how do we define our lives. Have you ever thought about that yourselves? How do you define
your life? Coordination.
Can you attend the light and see in the light?
Like that? Okay. Whoa. Here we go.
I'm not ready to see the light.
Oh, man. But, you know, if you think about it, we all have to define life in a certain way. I mean, everybody has the ability and the power to define their own life. Let me just give you some ideas. We define issues in different ways. And I was thinking about some of our current world situations. I mean, we've got a war that was in Iraq. We've got a political system in our country. And, for example, some people define the war as a war of liberation. Other people define the same war as a war of, what is it? What's the opposite?
Occupation.
Okay, so depending on what your point of view is, you've got two ways to look at something. The Republicans define politics in one way. The Democrats define it in another way. I remember some years ago, I had a gal that was, she was young. She was probably in her 20s, and she said, "I would never vote for Reagan, period." I said, "Really? Why?" She said, "Because of a woman's right to choose." I said, "Oh." And I said, is that the only reason?" And she thought, and she said, "Yeah." So she defined her political situation by one issue. I had another friend, a good buddy of mine, and he defined the political debate from an environmental standpoint. He said, "I would never vote for blah, blah, blah." I said, "Why?" "Because of the environment." Talked to another friend of mine who's a Republican, and I said, "You know, how do you define your political beliefs?" He says, "I believe that states' rights, basically. I don't believe the federal government should take and run from Washington local programs." That was how he defined it. And I'm not here to be in a political situation, but only to give this notion that we define life and issues in different ways. And so, as you think about it, as you define your life, how do you define it? Is it by your balance sheet? Is it by the number of dollars that you have in the bank? Is it by your marriage or non-marriage? Is it by your kids? How do you define this journey in life? Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. Stephen Covey wrote a book called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. How many people have heard about that book? Anybody read it? Very interesting book, and I highly recommend it. It's just some very good basic principles of life. And one of the things he says in there is he poses the question, what do you want people to say about you at your funeral? Have you ever sat down and just thought about that? When I go, what do I want people to say? My mother, who's just turned 70, lives in Wyoming, and we were up there in February, got a great zest for life. On her 70th birthday, there were 12 of us in the family, and we went up. She's at the back gate of Yellowstone, about 30 miles from the back gate there, and all 12 of us got on snowmobiles, and we rode 60 miles to the lodge because you can't get in any other way. And we had dinner, we stayed overnight, and then we came 60 miles out, and it was just a great, great time. And she said to me, you know what, when I die, I don't want any of the sad stuff. I want it to be, in, when she was in California, actually, before she left, she said, I want to go out and I want to have a big party. I want a Dixieland jazz band. And I want people to, you know, say what they remember. She wanted to remember life. And I always think that, you know, she's such a great example for me because she lives life. I want to share with you just a little story and then go into maybe some of the things that Jesus Christ said about defining life. World War II. Anybody heard of a theologian named Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Okay. I saw a documentary on him. And he's a very interesting man. He was in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And he was from a very upper class or established German family. His father was a psychologist. His brother was in World War I, who came back with his leg blown off. And he was very disturbed about this whole issue of war. And so he decided he was going to study theology. So he went to seminary, and his family kind of didn't get it. That, you know, it wasn't like this relevant thing. The church was something that was polite that you went to on Sunday, but it really didn't encompass, you know, your life. It was kind of this one little segment sort of a thing. And he wrote his thesis on really the community of Christians, of this new family, this new spiritual community, as it were, that he thought was so important for us to experience, really to experience God. He said that to be in relationship with each other is to ultimately experience God. And he put it in the backdrop of Germany that was going through economically a very difficult time. And so the relevancy, it was very difficult for him to communicate this point. And he was an avowed pacifist. In his early life, he was, you know, he didn't believe that war was an acceptable option. And as he went on, he actually went over to New York, Union City, had an incredible experience. He studied there, and he went to this church in Union City, and it was the oldest black church in America. And he went from this very German, you know, straightforward, to these black people that were just singing the gospel, and they were experiencing their faith in a very emotional sort of way. And he had a great heart for these people. And coming from Germany, where the Jews were persecuted, he saw this great parallel between the blacks and the Jews, actually. And as he went back to Germany, Hitler was, in the early days, was very well thought of. That's how he rose to power. He didn't come into power overnight. And back Bonhoeffer, along with so many, even the Catholic Church at the time, kind of endorsed this whole movement of Hitler. But then Hitler started, there was this movement in Germany because the economy was getting really bad, and there was a monarchist. They wanted to go back to the days of the monarchy. And Hitler said, no, no, we're going to substitute that with a leader state mentality. And so he started to become a demigod. Basically, people were, this whole philosophy or this thought that salvation was in Hitler. Okay, so he's coming on very strong, and Hitler literally was preaching in the parks, and he was rising in power. And Bonhoeffer had this incredibly devout feeling about his faith, and he was actually on the radio, and he says, this thing about Hitler being, you know, salvation is not in Hitler, it's in Jesus Christ. And they literally cut the broadcast off right at that minute. And so he was right in this beginning of the resistance against Hitler. And there's kind of this arc of the character that I want to show here, is when he was over in New York, and he met this Frenchman, and the Germans and the French didn't get along back then. They kind of fought a lot back in those eras. Another avowed pacifist, and he was becoming very entrenched in it, but with the continued persecution of the Jews, and actually the Catholics too. And I heard that there were 500,000 Catholics that were killed by Hitler, as well as the 5 million Jews that were killed by Hitler, is that he began to be part of the resistance. And he ended up, here's this guy who's a theologian. He wrote one of the most astounding books on ethics that you'll ever read. In fact, it's kind of one of the standard books, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And over this arc in this time, he had to wrestle with these issues of these theological systems. They were systems of thought, and he happened to be in this pacifist system. And with all of these people that were dying around him and being murdered and just slaughtered in such an ungodly way, he ended up becoming a double agent, if you can imagine. He was a double agent against Hitler. And I think it was for about 4 years. And ultimately, and he would ask his theological buddies, is there ever absolution if you kill someone? And they're thinking it's just in this generic theological discourse sort of a way. And only one other person knew that he was actually in the movement of the people that attempted to assassinate Hitler. Now, I find this really fascinating because it integrates life. It takes the spiritual thing and it puts it in the context of life. It's not this thing that we detach and we have this dualism where we go to church and we have this one little spot where, you know, we have this idealistic thought pattern and then we go back in the world. This is a guy that had to deal with life. And I'm not saying that he was right or wrong. That's not the point. But he had to wrestle with these issues of this tyrant. And what was he going to do? His brother was, you know, his leg got shot off in World War I, and he went through this period of time. And he knew that if he didn't do something, and if there wasn't a movement against Hitler, that atrocities would happen. Well, ultimately, he got caught. And he went to the concentration camp, and they hung him. And right before he died, he says, "Now I live." And I found that very, very striking because of the commitment that he had to follow his faith. Now, the thing that I found interesting, because he was a very studied theologian, and he had all of these systems down, and I actually spent a little bit of time in Bible school and studied theology and great systems of thought, and I'm very thankful for those years. But the thing that Dietrich Bonhoeffer came to the ultimate realization was, it wasn't about a system of rules, it was about listening to the inner voice of God. And you know, it's real interesting, if you look at great men in the Bible, and great women in the Bible, read Hebrews 11, you'll read some of the most fascinating stories about, they call it the Hall of Fame, the saints in the Hall of Fame. And they did some of the wackiest things. There was Rahab's lie. Rahab lied when the bad guys came and said, "Where are the Israelites?" And she said, "They went that way." And they didn't. They went that way. There were things that people did that were really contrary to these systems of thought, and they were even noted in the Bible as great people. There's the example that, I was baffled by this for many years. You know, when Abraham offered up Isaac, and you know, you think, and I've had people say, "That's the most barbaric thing. That just can't be true. It's symbolic." And I would suggest to you that, and I'll share a little bit more on that later, is that what Abraham did was really a type of what God the Father did with God the Son. He gave his only begotten Son as a sacrifice. And it was purely as an example. I don't believe God ever intended for Abraham to slay his own son. I believe it was an example to show a picture of what was to come when Jesus Christ came to the earth so that we would better understand the sacrifice of Christ. But when we get past this whole system of theology now, I want to kind of fast forward here to the New Testament in terms of how do you define your life. Paul, the Apostle Paul, who was a very upper-class guy, was in the Sanhedrin. He was one of 70 elders. He was probably the scholar of scholars. He knew the Old Testament upside down, inside out, word by word in his memory. He was very held in high esteem. In the early days, he was out persecuting Christians because he thought it was contrary to Judaism at the time. And then all of a sudden, he's walking down the road, and a light out of heaven literally blinded him. And Jesus said, his name was Saul before, they changed it after the experience. Saul, why do you persecute me? And he says, "Is that you, Lord?" Here's a man that was seeking God, but he didn't, he missed it. And so God had to have this supernatural experience to get his attention. And Paul says a very interesting thing. He says, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. He also says in the book of Colossians, he says, set your mind on the things above, for you died, and your life is now hidden in Christ with God. Very interesting. It's a very revolutionary thought, because it's kind of this whole idea of a substitutionary principle. It's when we actually get to this point where we die, we come to life. Jesus said a very, it was almost outlandish. He says, if you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you seek to lose your life for my name's sake, you'll gain it. You'll find it. And I thought, gosh, that's very exclusionary. How can that work? How is it that he can make that claim? And you know what's really an interesting thing is that when we... I get nervous after I want to do this once in a while. When we get to this point where we realize that in our humanity that we're limited, and in our divinity, which Jesus Christ is our bridge to our divinity, we open up to this world where it doesn't matter anymore, because if we've died with Christ and our life is hidden in Christ and God, all of a sudden we have new life, everything that we're directed to do. And if we look internally and we begin to experience this vesselship, and there's a lot of words that are used for it, but if we experience this mediumship, if we experience this service thing, if we get out of our own skin and we realize that really our life is about service, that our life is about allowing the life of the living God to flow through us and to other people to affect them, I've got to tell you something. When I'm in that zone, it's amazing, this stuff. And I know that you've got the same experiences. And isn't it interesting how quickly we can get back, and we can capture our life, and we get back behind the steering wheel, and you know, we're in control, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're kind of going these ways, and things kind of get messed up, and it's like God has to get our attention. I was driving a friend of mine that Millie had mentioned, 47 years old, a friend of mine for 10, 15 years, cancer. They gave her two months to live. Had emergency surgery last week for an intestinal blockage, and took some more tumors out, and they think she's got maybe a few more months. This is the Western doctors. And so I took her up to Santa Ana today for this Qigong guy. He's an energy healer. It's some Chinese guy. And she's on some other things that I think are promising. And she made a very interesting comment to me, because I've really never had a friend that had a terminal illness, and you kind of gulp. It's like, what do you say to them? And I hadn't seen her for a year. We kind of been in different places, and I heard, and when I saw her, you know, I started to get kind of teary-eyed, because, you know, this is a person who's so full of life, and so, and you know, and very willful, very strong-willed. And she's now like 100 pounds, and you know, her goal right now is to be able to go up and downstairs 4 times a day so she can get food. And but she's going to beat it, and she believes she's going to beat it, and I actually think she's going to beat it. But she said a very interesting thing, because I think it comes down in many ways to a spiritual question. She said, Dan, it really took God a big one to get my attention. It took a big deal to get my attention. And I listen to that, and I get goosebumps, because I think, you know, I'm pretty hard-headed sometimes, and I hope that, you know, it doesn't take that to get my attention. Really. And so, as you define your life, and as I define my life, I might just suggest to you that this whole notion and this whole experience of Jesus Christ, the indwelling Holy Spirit in us and through us, to show the light to the world, that we would be the light to the world, is an experience that's far superior to anything that we can naturally come up with, anything that we can manufacture, whether it be by career or by all the perfect externals, if you know what I mean. Having the perfect this or the perfect that, it really doesn't compare to the idea that we can be the light of God, we can have the living God living in us and through us, and we can literally see miraculous things happen, and they don't have to be flashy miraculous things, but just that knowing that, you know, it's just this far from the other side of the veil. And rather than looking externally, it's looking internally to where we have that divinity, that divine part of us. And you know that, I spoke on this some time ago, where Paul in Ephesians, he prays, he says, "For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom the whole family on heaven and in earth derives its name." And he says, "That you might experience the height and the depth, the breadth and the width of the love of Christ, and he might dwell in your hearts through faith." And then he goes on and he says, right at the end of that prayer, and it's magnificent, he says, "Now, after Christ is dwelling in your heart through faith and dependence in this internal life and this spiritual reality that we're on this path," he says, "Now, unto him who is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, above and beyond all that we ask or think." How? "According to the power," the dunamis was the Greek word, the dynamic power that works within us, "to him be the glory forever." And it's that instant. It's that accessible to us because we have that ability through Christ to communicate and to be part of that family in heaven and in earth. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.